stop justifying why you can't go or why you shouldn't go and just do it. You know, I only get so much vacation time, and to spend a chunk of it away from my wife and kids, you will be a better man coming back out of the woods, and you'll be better man for them if you get that time.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 131. Thank you guys for joining us. Our guest on this one is Eric Voris from Late to the Game Outdoors. So as the name implies, with Late to the Game, Eric started hunting later in life. And we talk a bit about that and his journey and some stories, which are both hilarious and helpful. This episode had lots of laughs, but some good information packed into it as well as maybe a good kick in the pants for some of you guys who are out there and maybe have excuses about why you can't do this backcountry hunting thing. Well, tune into this one. Listen up. Let's make this happen, guys. You can do it. Hope you enjoy this one. Before we get into it, wanted to give a shout out to Luke Werner for the iTunes review. Luke, we want to send you some swag, so send us your shipping information to podcast@exomountaingear.com. And listeners, if you want to be entered into these giveaways, it's really simple. We just want to hear from you. Leave us a review on iTunes or send us your comments, questions, or feedback directly to podcast@exomountaingear.com. We'd love to help, so let us know how we can do it. All right, let's dive into this episode with Eric Voris from Late to the Game Outdoors. Eric, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. This is going to be a good one. I think you have an interesting perspective and story that is different than some of what we've covered so far. So I'm glad to make this happen.
Oh, man, me too. Thanks for saying that.
So I want to jump right into kind of your story and your background. You kind of shared a little bit with me, but I want to go straight to your 18th birthday. And you mentioned you got your first gun then. Is that right?
That is, yeah, which makes me sound like a psycho. My whole outdoors experience growing up was Boy Scouts. If it weren't for them, I probably never would have been camping. And at Boy Scout camp, fell in love with shooting. They had a range, and I spent every afternoon down at the range shooting 22s and muzzle loaders and these little recurve bows that I sucked at. I came back home and was begging my parents, like, please, let me get a gun. Let me get a BB gun. Let me get something. And they weren't like hippies or anything. They were just convinced I was going to shoot my siblings. So they shut that down. Just, we had no guns in our household at all growing up. But I never lost that love of shooting. So turned 18, told them I wanted a gun. They gave me some money. And I went down to a gun shop and bought a 12 gauge because at 18, that's what can blow things up the best in the desert. So that's what I picked. I had a buddy who was, he was from a more gun-friendly family, and we just went shooting all the time and, you know, built up the collection a little bit from there. But it started on my birthday with a 12 gauge because I was determined I was going to be an outdoorsman of some sort.
So was that really like that in you, the draw to the outdoors, not just shooting, but to the outdoors and pursuits, and obviously we're going to get to hunting. Was that really from the Boy Scouts, you think, or were there other influences kind of growing up, even though you didn't have kind of this outdoors hunting childhood?
I think it was all Boy Scouts. I didn't know until Boy Scouts. I think I was 9 or 10 when I went on my first overnight camping trip with them, and just loved everything about it, the tent and the wilderness and all of that. And so that was like, I lived for those weekend trips with the scouts where we'd go backpacking or do whatever. And then life, you know, takes a different turn through adolescence and kind of fell out of it. My family was just not outdoorsy. It just wasn't something that we did. But I was always trying to find reasons to get back in the outdoors. And I fell in love with nature back then and wanted to spend as much time as possible, even though hunting at that point wasn't a part of it.
So it was later on when you met your girlfriend and then met her family, and you said that your girlfriend's dad had a quote-unquote den full of heads and kind of give you some exposure to hunting through your girlfriend's dad. Walk us through that, meeting him, kind of seeing that. Was that immediately like you had a draw to that and an interest to that?
Yeah, it was a weird 50-50 because she's my wife now, but at the time I was just meeting my girlfriend's parents. And to my knowledge, I'm sure I had been around hunters, but didn't know it. We never talked about it. So I think she had prepped me that he was a hunter, but I walked in and here's this guy who's, I'm semi-tall, but he's, you know, a couple inches taller than me. He's 3 bills at the time. I think he had like the Paul Senior mustache from all Orange County Choppers, like just a big, scary dude. And so I was already just hyper intimidated. And he, I think because he could pick up on that, made a point of taking me into his den where he just had all the mounts and the just having no frame of reference. My first reaction was just fear. Like, this guy knows how to kill living creatures. I'm a living creature and I'm dating his daughter. So, you know, I could just see the spot on the wall that would be great for my head. And so it was freaked out at first. But as I got over that moment, the other part of me was like, holy crap, this would be awesome. Like, I want to know about this. And so just started asking him a bunch of questions. I was just super curious about it once I got comfortable enough to actually speak to the man.
How old were you at this time?
I think I was 19 then.
Okay, so this is still pretty early.
Yeah.
So, and he actually took you on your first hunt, right?
He did. Yeah, it was a Christmas gift when my wife and I were engaged. I opened up a little box that had a camo shirt, and tucked in the pocket was a license and a tag for archery cow hunt.
Wow.
Up north. And so I was super pumped and also had no idea what I was in for, what I was doing. And it was, I mean, it was, I don't think there's a thing I did right on that hunt, but it was super awesome.
So were you shooting a bow already at the time, or you get this archery tag and you're like, oh crap, better figure out how to shoot a bow so I can hunt?
Yeah, it was that for
wow.
sure.
Yeah,
he had an old, I think the first bow he ever bought, it was like a PSE from World War One or something. It was so old. But it was like sitting in the garage and he set it up for me, and it was not pretty. Like, I think my limit on the range was like 30 yards because I was super scrawny. And I just remember him dialing that draw weight back over and over until I could actually draw the bow. And so I think we didn't measure it, but I'm betting it was 50 pounds at most of draw weight. And like, the arrow, if you could granny shot an arrow, that's how they were flying in, like just this huge rainbow arc. And he just kind of told me as we marked off some stuff, he's like, hey, if it's past 30, don't shoot at it. So yeah, I was just trying to figure all that out over that summer leading into that hunt.
Wow. So that hunt, what happened? I guess we'll get to, was it successful? But really, were you just hooked after that hunt?
I was hooked, and then like life circumstances happened. We moved away for a couple of years. Like I was hooked, but I wasn't able to pursue it the way I wanted to. But yeah, what happened was I came stupid close to elk. Man, this sounds so stupid just to even say it, but we set me up in a ground blind. My father-in-law is at the point of his life where he likes to tree stand hunt rather than just walk around the woods forever, which I totally get. So he was, on the way to his tree, we just kind of set up this blind and he taped off some markers and just kind of was trying to like download all the information he thought I would need, where he's like, I'm going to drop you off here. You're going to sit here. The elk usually come from the south, so be looking in this drainage. And I had nothing. Like, I was thinking about it the other day. I believe my day pack was literally a JanSport backpack from school that I was hauling into the woods to haul meat out, which is the stupidest thing ever. So I just kind of made this blind and I was sitting on a stump facing south opening morning. We got in there before dawn. And so I'm all pumped like everybody is, like, surely the sun's going to come up and elk's going to walk by. It's going to die. This is going to be great. And then as hours go by and that doesn't happen, you start to get sleepy. And so basically I was nodding off. And then suddenly I was awoken by this screaming bugle right behind me. And I slowly turned my head, and less than 10 yards, probably 6-7 yards, is this giant bull with 5 cows right behind me, because they snuck in the direction he didn't tell me they were going to come from. Because who knew? Elk do whatever they want. And I'm sitting there like, oh, shoot. Okay, I gotta drop to my knee. I got to turn around. And he didn't tell me to sit there with an arrow knocked. So I'm trying in one motion to like drop to my knees, turn around, get an arrow out of the quiver, knock it. And, you know, I got halfway through that before they realized something was up and jumped the barbed wire fence and took off. But just that like heart pounding adrenaline, like, holy crap, these giant animals are right here. And I'm, you know, within inches of killing them, was amazing. That was the closest encounter I had that hunt. We walked around for another few days and didn't come anywhere as close as that. But just that chasing that adrenaline rush, became pretty addicting.
Then you said you had this gap, you guys moved, and then somewhere around the age of 30 is when you really wanted to start picking up and getting into hunting, which kind of leads us into what you're up to now and the site and this whole idea of being late to the game, as you've called it. For guys who are hearing this, maybe they're new to hunting, maybe they haven't even gone hunting yet, or they're just doing it for a few years, and they're older. I mean, they're, you know, in their 20s or in their 30s or 40s or 50s. Some of these guys, they're not old, but there's also this idea that to be a hunter, you have to be raised a hunter. You have to be raised by a hunter. You have to start when you're 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. What would you say to those guys who, like you, were getting into this later in the game?
Yeah, basically, to the shortest way I would say it is, if I can figure this out, anybody can do this. But yeah, that was the desire behind it, was as much as I am indebted to all the experts who have just shared so much, a lifetime of information, it feels like all the guys were raised in the woods. And when you're like me and, you know, you have a couple seasons go by where you're just not successful, you think, well, man, maybe I've missed that window. Like, by the time I learn how to do this, I'll be too old to get out in the woods. And just the desire was like, no, if you can walk, if you can carry a few pounds on your back, you can get out there and hunt. So just trying to come at it from that perspective, like, hey, I'm making stupid mistakes that I'm sure the Corey Jacobsons of the world made when they were 9 and never made again. But you can still overcome that. You can still figure things out and be a successful hunter. So it's really just trying to lower that barrier to entry. Like, get yourself some used or some borrowed gear, grab a tag, learn as much as you can, but just get out and try it and you'll figure stuff out.
So it sounds like you had some good, you know, your father-in-law, some other good hunting mentors maybe, but what other lessons or resources or things come to mind that have helped you as you've gotten into this?
Oh, man. Yeah, I've learned a lot from my father-in-law, my brother-in-law, a lot from your podcast, not a cheesy plug, but I listen to you guys all the time, and the guests you bring on, just always picking something up. There's a few other podcasts out there. Pretty much if I'm driving, I have a hunting podcast playing, just trying to glean from those guys. A lot of the popular YouTube channels, I've watched a lot of Corey Jacobson, a lot of the born and raised guys. I've got Ranella's books that I kind of thumb through sections of. And yeah, I've just tried to put it all together and just steal resources where I can. The couple of those calling apps, I think you guys have had both the turkey and the elk guy on there. I got those apps and trying to get my calling dialed in. Like, the resources are out there, and a lot of times they're free. Just tried to glean as much as I can find.
So I want to kind of dissect your experience really with this process. Begin to walk us through when you picked this up more seriously and kind of had more time to pursue hunting. And then what did the process look like for you to actually go through some of these mistakes, learn some lessons before you were actually finding success? Was that a short learning curve? Was it, you know, kind of fumbling along the way? Walk us through that experience.
Yeah, it was. So I think for a couple years after we moved back to town, I would go hunting with my father-in-law, but I was just along for the ride. So he would put us in wherever, and we didn't spend the time. So we would have a weekend. We didn't do any scouting. It was just, hey, we're going to go to this spot and camp, and we'll hike up to this mountain and glass. And a couple of those trips in a row, we just basically camped with guns. Like, we didn't see a single deer. We're just out in the desert. Nothing happened. And then a year or two after that, like, we kind of got skunked on the draw for a couple years. And I just got to this point where I was like, this is stupid. I live in Arizona. We're not as over the counter as some other states, but we've got good hunting opportunities. And I just kind of made this determination that I want to hunt once or twice at least every year. And so to do that, I'm going to need a bow. I'm going to need to just be intentional about my calendar and my plans, and just find ways to get in the field and pursue something. So I think I scraped together some gift cards and some Christmas cash and a sale, and bought like a lower level bow at Cabela's. Just kind of outfitted myself there and started trying to dial that in. There was a hunt where I borrowed a different bow from my brother-in-law. And just went archery hunting in the desert. And I just kind of, for the first time, started driving that. Whereas my father-in-law would always just tell me, hey, I put us in and we're going to go hunting here. This time I was like, hey, we didn't get drawn. I'm buying an over-the-counter deer tag. I'm thinking about going to this spot. If you want to come with me, cool, but I'm going one way or the other. And just kind of got this drive that I wanted to be in the field. And so there were a couple years there where nothing. Like, I was doing a lot of Google Earth scouting, and I didn't even have time to really, like, devote a week in the field. So I would just do some back and forth trips, like single day hunts, come back at night, maybe go to work the next day, and maybe duck out of work early to try to catch an evening hunt. Like, I was just trying to scrape together whatever time I could find, hunting sort of close by. And, you know, I would find sign, I would try different blinds, I would try to glass from a hill, I would try to sit on water. I just kept trying all these different things. And wasn't really successful with a lot of them, but I learned a lot about what works, or times of day, or really I learned the value of scouting, of actually getting boots on the ground where you're going, and trying to find them before you just get out there and hope that magically you found a tank on Google Earth and surely deer are going to show up when you're there, because that often doesn't work, is what I learned. Yeah, so that was a couple of years of long learning curve. That's when I was starting to, like, pull together podcasts and figure stuff out. And then I think 2016, I drew a bull tag in northern Arizona. And my father-in-law, brother-in-law, and I all had that tag. Went up north. We hunted for a week. And that was probably the steepest learning curve, because it was far enough away I had to be gone. So I was just off work, away from my family, up in the woods for a week. Just hunting all day, every day for 6 or 7 days. And I was not successful on that hunt, but made so many stalks, blew so many elk out of the area, you know, messed up the wind a million times, just the day after day, making stupid mistakes and then trying to correct from that. And by the end, I was getting close. I had a couple of super close encounters, let an arrow fly at one that a limb, you know, it was just one of those crazy tiny windows through the trees where I could just see his vitals, and gave it a shot. And of course the arrow bounced around and he took off, but came super close a few times and started to feel like, okay, I'm good. You know, if I had a couple more days, I'd probably be able to put an elk down. And then shortly after that, rifle deer season happened. I was successful there. Then the following year, somehow, all statistical anomalies, drew the same bull tag the next year, which is impossible in Arizona. And that was last year's hunt, where went up there and it took 5 days, but finally was able to put an elk down with my bow. And so after a couple semi-successful years, you know, a rifle mule deer in 2016, a archery bull in 2017, started to think like, okay, I'm starting to figure this out. I'm starting to get to a point where, not that I can expect success all the time, because no one can, but like there's progress being made here.
You mentioned the 2016 mule deer, which was your first big game harvest, right?
Yes, it was.
So you have a great story on your site written up about that, but can you share kind of the Barney Fife aspect and such a good story with this first one and how it went down?
Oh yeah, I was such an idiot. That mule deer hunt was in the desert, and it was technically private land. So I think he's my cousin-in-law technically, but he runs a big alfalfa and hay farm out in the middle of the desert. So all these mule deer that are hanging around, they just kind of flocked this thing because there's water and there's food. And so he gave us permission to hunt there, and we went out, and I had told myself when I drew the tag that, okay, next time I draw a rifle deer tag, I'm going to finally buy a rifle. Because up till then, I've just been hunting with this borrowed old Mossberg 30-06 that my father-in-law had lying around. And so finally decided I'm going to buy a rifle. And I found out later the problem was I mounted the scope wrong. So I looked at mount this with 15-inch pounds. And I thought, well, I'm a DIY guy, but I'm also cheap. So I thought, well, I'm not going to buy the torque wrench thing. Surely my forearm will know what 15-inch pounds feels like. And I torqued that thing down way too much and then created kind of this, you get that like inconsistent flyers that come out of nowhere. So was fighting the rifle all weekend, burned like a whole morning of hunting just out in the desert trying to sight it in again. And I just couldn't get consistent. In hindsight, I should have just given up on that gun and borrowed my father-in-law's rifle. But I was too prideful and too determined to shoot the deer with my rifle. Anyway, I think it was the third morning. We went out there, wasn't super confident in the rifle, but I had burned like a box and a half of ammo trying to sight back in. So I had 8 bullets left, and the rifle I was shooting had a 3-round mag. So I had 4 in the gun, a spare mag of 3, and I had this one loose bullet in a box in the back of the Jeep. That as we're grabbing our gear, I looked at that bullet and I thought, I'm not going to need this. I have 7 rounds. Who can't put a deer down with 7 rounds? So just tossed it aside in the back of the Jeep, and we walked about a half mile into our blind. And as the sun was coming up, we were facing east, and it's just getting bright enough that we can see these deer are kind of moving across the field on their way back out to the desert. And as light comes up, there's this big full-bodied 4x4 standing kind of near the road next to the fence about to jump over. And so I decide I'm going to take a shot at him, but he's at just such an angle that I get this glare in my scope. So I can't see anything. So I keep moving around trying to like shift my cheek weld, just get an angle where I can see the stupid deer. And my father-in-law is just on the glasses, just watching the whole thing so he can kind of be my spotter. And so I think I took a range on him. He was somewhere around 200. And I put what I thought would be the correct hash mark on him and fired. And my father-in-law was like, no, you missed. So I missed that first shot. And then I looked up to see if he was down. He wasn't. So I went back to the scope. The glare was back. So I'm shifting again, trying to get an angle. This deer is kind of wandering around, but isn't bailing yet. Took another shot. My father-in-law said I missed low, jacked a third round in there. And just as he was up against the fence about to bail, I took one more shot. Missed him far to the right somehow because that scope was all jacked up. So he takes off into the desert and I'm just deflated. Like I just took 3 shots at this beautiful buck. He's gone. And then I start scanning this line of deer that are working their way across the field. It's a bunch of does, but there's this nice big 3x4 sitting out in the middle. I think, okay, well, he'll eat just as nice. So I turn my attention to him. And now I have a magazine with 1 round in it and a spare mag with 3 sitting next to me. So I swap mags. So I have this magazine with 1 round, and I put a fresh 3 in the gun, set up on him. I range him at 220. So I'm trying to, at this point, I'm frustrated. My adrenaline's going. My ears are ringing. Like I'm doing everything I can to calm down. Put a hash mark on him, fire. My father-in-law's whispering me the whole time, like, okay, you missed low. So I put another round, and the deer like trots off a little ways. The does are running in and out all around, but you know, he kind of stops after going 30, 40 yards, and he's looking around to figure out what's going on. So I'm trying to guess yardages each time he moves away. He finally gives a shot. I take another shot, miss low again, put another round in, and I just keep kind of going up different hash marks on the scope because I'm just blindly guessing range at this point. Finally, I crack that third shot off, and you hear that thwack. My father's like, okay, you hit him, but he didn't go down, so you need to finish him. So now I've emptied that mag. I have that first mag with 1 bullet in it, so I swap it out again. This is the last round I have on me. He's kind of stopped. I probably should have stopped and taken a fresh range, but I think, okay, I hit him on that, whatever hash mark I used. I'm going to use that again. slow deep breath, trying to get all my fundamentals, trying to calm down. I crack that last shot off, and my father-in-law whispers, "Yeah, you missed him to the left." So now I am officially out of ammo. My father-in-law has been watching through the glass. He doesn't know my plight, and so he's just sitting over there, like whispering, like, "All right, whenever you're ready, shoot him. You got to shoot him again. Whenever you're ready." And so finally, I'm just kind of stunned, and I lean over. I'm like, "I'm out of bullets." And he gives up on whispering. He's like, "You what?" And like, I have one more back in the Jeep. And he's like, "Well, it looks like you're going back to the Jeep." So I drop all the gear. I grab the keys. He just kind of stays there in the blind with his binoculars just to keep an eye on this deer. And I run a half mile back to the Jeep. At this point, like what happened is I gut shot him, which I feel terrible about. So I'm trying to hurry to put this poor thing out of its misery. But he's not really going anywhere. So I grab the Jeep. I drive right up to our blind, jump out, grab that round, grab my rifle. And I think, okay, I need to get as close as I can. At this point, he's probably close to 300 yards away from our blind. So I duck down into this field where there's kind of this berm, and I just sort of like crawl on my hands and knees up along this out of his sight to try to get as close as I can. And I pop up at the edge of this berm and range him, and he's at 160. And so I think, okay, this is literally the last bullet I have in my possession. He's at 160, standing still. The does have taken off at this point. And so I just lay there. I probably took 20 deep breaths, and literally I'm like praying, please let this bullet go where it needs to go. Because if this fails, I have my sidearm on my hip, and I can run out there John Wick style and try to put him down. But that's my only other option. And just enough deep breaths, squeeze the trigger. That shot hit exactly behind the shoulder where it needed to go, and he dropped immediately. But it was a long and embarrassing first mule deer down.
It's exactly what everyone pictures for their first harvest, I'm sure.
Yeah. No one pictures that.
I don't think you're alone. Shot.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, so dumb. So now I always carry a stupid amount of ammunition with me if I'm rifle hunting.
You go out like Rambo.
Yeah, just the bandoliers across my chest.
Oh geez. Yeah, I mean it's so awesome. Like, I'm glad you share that. It's refreshing because there is this. Whatever. I mean, people just, they don't let out the reality sometimes, right? Like, especially as we're learning and making mistakes, we want to cover that up and not admit things. But at the same time, we've all made so many stupid mistakes that we just have to get that out there. So I'm glad that you're, open and sharing that process for sure.
Oh, I do stupid stuff all the time. And I figure it helps lower that barrier to entry in the outdoors and maybe lets people chuckle a little bit, and both of those are valuable to me.
Yeah. So let's talk about your 2017 elk hunt a bit. Your first elk, archery elk. I watched the video, which that alone is surprising. It's your first archery bull harvest, and you're self-filming this thing. That's quite ambitious alone to try and get this all on film while you're trying to still learn hunting. So kudos to you, man.
Hey, thanks. Yeah. I figured bow hunting isn't hard enough. I should probably carry cameras around and crap.
So going into 2017, you mentioned you drew this tag in 2016, you got close. You thought, if I had a few more days, I could figure this out. Going into 2017, then, were you feeling pretty confident?
I was, not overly, I didn't want to be overly confident, but I knew the area. I'd been there last year. I had put in a bunch of time scouting over the summer. I think I only had one cam at the time, but I had a game cam out there that I kept moving around and checking spots. So I was pretty confident. I knew where the elk would theoretically be. I had been shooting a lot. I'm not dropping, quarter size groups at 80 yards or anything. Within my archery limitations, I felt like if I felt like I could get myself opportunities that I couldn't before, and I felt pretty confident that I could make that shot happen if the opportunity presented itself.
Yeah. So going into this hunt, it wasn't locating elk wasn't a problem, or you didn't think it'd be a problem. But I know that they weren't being super responsive to calls or super aggressive. You didn't like kind of catch that peak rut. How did you? What was your strategy given that?
Yeah, we probably changed strategies three or four times throughout the hunt, which was, I was just watching the Born and Raised guys and their whole, like, they just keep saying, you run your playbook and wait for the bull that wants to play your game. And those guys are wildly more successful than me, but I decided to disregard their advice and just keep trying different things. So we went in the first day, they were just stone cold silent. They didn't care what we threw at them. I'm trying to get better, but I suck as a caller. So my brother-in-law was doing most of the calling, and he's not a big fan of bugling. He likes to just cow call them. And they just didn't care and weren't making any noise. And the next couple days they were starting to bugle early in the morning, but they really didn't care about our calls. We threw a bunch of cow stuff at them, threw some bugles. They just, no one wanted to come in or play. They would kind of look our direction. They would think about it for a second, and then they would just keep doing whatever they were doing. So then we kind of shifted more into an ambush strategy. We had tried still hunting just through the woods and the area we were in, and we just kept blowing them out before we could get close enough. So just kind of decided, we had located a spot or two out in the woods where there's pretty heavy elk traffic, and just kind of decided to set ourselves up and wait and just hope one came in the right spot at the right time.
What was it in that area? Were they just moving from like feed to bed? Like, what was the pattern that you guys were observing in that they were moving through that area?
Yeah, there was kind of a little drainage. So it's a pretty flat but thickly wooded area. So there's lots of bedding areas, and then, you know, plenty of meadows where they go out and feed. And so we would just kind of find them mostly hanging low in that drainage. And we were set up kind of on the edge of the drainage where they would come into the thicker timber and kind of the softer stuff to bed down. So I'm sure they were out there in the fields feeding, you know, even before light, because the moon wasn't cooperating all that well. And then as the sun started to come up, they would use that drainage as sort of protection and then cross over up into a thick bedding area.
And is that something you're aware of before the hunt from your scouting?
I had not been up in that. I knew there was a bedding area there because we had set my father-in-law's tree stand nearby in the summer. And when we were out there, there's tons of sign. We were spooking cows out of the area a lot when we were hanging his tree. So so we knew they'd be in that area. But it was really him sitting up in his tree the first couple of days where he just said, hey, you know, to the north, he was seeing some elk come by. But he just kept seeing out of his range to the north. He just kept seeing and hearing these elk move along this drainage and up into the bedding area. So he kind of tipped us off and said, you might want to sit up in that region. Because they were out of his range anyway, but he just kept seeing groups of elk.
Setting up in this ambush style, you kind of know they're moving through, you're getting in that proximity. Was it still in your mind to call to them once you saw them, or were you just trying to essentially get close enough and have a good shot opportunity, staying completely silent?
I had given up on calling because my brother-in-law had heard me let out a few cow calls, and he was like, no, you suck. You need to stop. he's a very loving man, but he kind of shut that down, like, you get better, you stop calling. So I was just kind of letting him drive the calling boat, really. And when we would see a bull, he let out some cow calls, which never seemed to like bring them in or anything. A few times it seemed like, if nothing else, it helped kind of calm them down. Like, they got the impression that there were elk in the area. So this one, the lone bull that I ended up shooting, never, like, he would look at us and hear the calls, but never felt like he wanted to come into it, but at least looked like he didn't get spooked or anything. He just kind of felt comfortable to go about his business because he's like, okay, there's other elk in the area, and it wasn't peak rut. So he didn't seem to care about investigating that cow at all.
To cut to the chase, like, you ended up crawling in. Was that on a bedded bull?
Yes. So this bull came through, and we had kind of set up our blind at like a 90 degree wedge. And we just sort of had this agreement, like, if it comes in on Zach's side, it's my brother-in-law, it's his. If it comes in on my side, it's mine. And so he just happened to walk in on my side. He never came closer than 60 yards. And with my bow, I don't have a pin past 50. So, he kind of wandered a few yards out, and he bedded about 90 yards from us. The wind was howling, but he was upwind of us. So I thought, okay, the wind will hide my noise and my movement a little bit. And there was this like 30-yard clearing that I had to get through to try to get in range of him. But I was convinced if I let him get like just bed and we waited for a while and he got up, he was going to keep going the direction he was going. He wasn't going to come back our direction. So yeah, I just crawled in on them. I think the most of the time my brother-in-law was just still kind of throwing out cow calls every now and then just to try to mask any movement or anything he saw, maybe try to convince him it was a cow and not a human crawling. But yeah, just kind of hands and knees across that clearing, painfully slow, moving every pine cone and stick out of my way, just trying not to blow them out. And it took a while and was, you know, your adrenaline's going, it's really hard to crawl, I found, but was able to sneak into just above 50 yards on them and make a play on them.
That's awesome. So make the shot, you're able to track, make that harvest. What was it like walking up on your first elk, you know, bull elk with a bow at that?
Oh, man. It was when I first saw him, and I didn't happen to have the cameras rolling when we were first looking. I didn't expect to see him because I knew I had seen it. It hit, and it hit a little higher and a little further back than I expected. And so he was gushing blood. But I knew it wasn't like I hadn't smoked him through the lungs or anything. So I thought he was going to be a good ways away. So we were just getting on blood and just trying to, we tracked a few spots, found the arrow, found another spot. And then I just kind of looked up through the woods and saw him like, holy crap, he's laying right there. He didn't go more than 100 yards. And it was, I expected myself to like weep, but that didn't happen. It was just, joy and elation and accomplishment and just gratefulness. It's overwhelming, like every guy experiences, and I think we all handle it a little differently. More than anything, there was just this like deep satisfaction, like holy crap, I can actually do this. Because up till then, in the back of my head, there's always that like, am I gonna be hunting out here for 20 years just walking around with a bow and never harvest anything?
What would you say to a guy who's maybe listening to this and feeling that way right now?
Anything can change in a moment, which sounds so trite and so cheesy, but like at that point we had calls weren't working, still hunting wasn't working. We were just fully at the mercy of, we're in elk area and we're just gonna sit here behind a blind we made and just hope that an elk comes in the right spot at the right time. So there's so much of that is outside our control. Luck plays into every harvest, I think, but there was a lot of luck going on that made that happen. Just anything can change. If you're willing to stay out there, put in the time, and be aggressive when needed to roll the dice. Like I was half convinced when I started crawling across that clearing, like, okay, I'm going to bump him out and he's going to go away, but at least I tried. And it just happened to work. And had I never taken that chance, I'm sure I would have sat there watching him through binos. And eventually he would have gotten up and walked away and I never would have seen him again. So, things can change so fast and you can't kill him if you're not in the woods. So put in as much time as you can and something will eventually click.
Yeah. What do you take away from hunts that aren't, quote unquote, successful, meaning don't end up with a filled tag? Cause I know you've written a bit about, you know, how hunting, it's just like it connects with you as a man in a different way. And most of us, you know, guys who are kind of in that stage of life where it's, you know, it's work and it's kids and it's sports and it's, you know, all these demands and kind of just the stress and connectedness of modern life. And for you, I know that hunting's a good escape from all that stuff. So what do you take away from hunts that aren't just about the kill?
Oh man, it is deeply good and healthy for my soul just to be in the woods. I can feel it when I've gone too long between time in the field, and I just start to get restless and anxious, and like there's just kind of this like war within me, which sounds a little overly dramatic, but I can just tell like, okay, it's time to get in the woods. So man, I just take away, there is so much recharging that goes on. I think and just ponder a bunch of stuff while I'm out there. And so aside from, you know, if I'm hunting, I'm learning. So I figure stuff out and I think I become a better hunter, whether I harvest an animal or not. But deeper than that, man, I just get to recharge and I come back from the woods. My wife is amazing. And she gets it and she lets me have this time where she's single parenting while I'm off chasing whatever animal in the woods. But she does that partly because she knows I come back a better husband, a better father. because I've just had time to escape, to kind of let this, I tend to call it the primal man, that like inner part that I think most of us have that doesn't really have an outlet in our, you know, sort of cushy modern society. That guy gets to come out and play when you're chasing an animal and you're trying to survive in the woods, and letting him out every now and then, I think, just makes me a more complete, whole individual.
Just stepping back, big picture. If a guy's in a similar situation, is wanting to do something like this, to get out, to maybe he's hunted, but not like quite at the level where he's gone out on like this backcountry adventure, or maybe it's a guy who, if he wants to do it, he'd have to go out of state to do it, and maybe he's hearing about it and doesn't think he has the time or the money or whatever. What would you have them focus on if they want to get started doing something like this? Like, is it knowledge? Is it gear? Is it time? Like, what are some of the big things that somebody who's maybe, you know, late to the game that you would have them look at?
Man, I would have them put gear at the bottom of the list, because there's a lot you can get done with borrowed and used and, you know, entry level equipment. My bow's a piece of crap, and I was able to put a bull down with it. So I think we get hung up a lot on gear, and that's a barrier. Like, man, if I need to get the best stuff, it's going to cost thousands of dollars and whatever. Which there's something to be, good gear makes things easier, but it's not the main thing. So I would encourage guys to find as much time as they can. So whatever their family and professional situation is, bank up that time off. Try to persuade your wife or girlfriend or whoever that this, you will come back a better man if she lets you have this time away from her, and put in the time scouting, learning, just go in as knowledgeable of the area, as knowledgeable of the critter you're chasing, and with whatever gear you can scrape together, as long as you have the bare necessities to get the job done, that can take care of itself. It's more important, at least to me, to be in the field than it is to actually harvest an animal. That's great when that happens, and we love that meat and everything, but go give it a shot. You know, beg, borrow, and steal whatever you need to get out there, and prioritize the time and the tag more than the stuff.
Great advice.
You mentioned Arizona's not, obviously, especially when you get into elk and things like that, it's not a guaranteed tag even for you as a resident. So I know that it's kind of on your radar to start looking at maybe some out-of-state hunts. As someone who hasn't done that before, what kind of process are you going through to prepare for out-of-state hunts? What kind of questions are you asking yourself? Information are you trying to put together to make that happen?
Yeah, the first thing I'm doing, super practical, is just trying to set aside a little money every time, you know, every month, to kind of bank up that trip. So I don't have an elk tag this year, but I know financially it's not the year that I'm traveling out of state to do that. So just the super practical, trying to set aside some money for travel, for tags, for all that stuff. More than that, it's just it's pretty overwhelming when you first start thinking about it. Like, in your home state, you kind of know the areas, you know, you can kind of picture where units are, like, you just sort of know that because you live here. But to just look at Colorado or Idaho and just be like, okay, I'm going to get a tag and pick a spot on Google Earth that might hold elk. You know, that the fact that you can't just, you know, bomb up a couple hour drive and do some scouting, and you're going to have to just take your best guess and have 12 backup plans, is pretty intimidating. So at this point, I'm looking at a lot of, I'm still at the look at the, you know, the game and fish for that state and just figure out how their rules and seasons and units work, and starting to poke around forums, and guys are understandably, you know, no one's just giving away their honey holes. So just trying to like come up with a list of 20 best guesses, and just know that first year, I'm going to go in with low expectations that, hey, I will probably not harvest a bull. And then if I do, it's a bonus. But that first year is going to be just a huge learning curve of figuring out how to go out of state and find a spot and hunt it hard and adapt and improvise along the way.
Yeah, it is. It's a whole different deal when you're looking at going out of state. As you mentioned, just trying to figure out areas, understand the regulations, it can be overwhelming. But it's so worth the effort. And the thing is, even though it's overwhelming at first, it's all stuff that can be figured out. You just have to put in a little time and effort to do it.
Totally.
This is awesome. So going forward, anything else that just stands out as advice for people who are maybe getting into this later in the game, or any specific resources you would point them to?
Oh, man. This will sound cryptic, but if you're later into the game and thinking about getting into it and you think like, yeah, I might be too old, the honest advice is you're not getting any younger. So it's not going to be any easier down the road to get into it. But as trite as this sounds, like you get one life. So, you know, I didn't want to be reaching the end of my life. Like, man, I should have hunted more. I should have pursued this. I think, you know, our biggest regrets are the stuff that we don't do or we pass up on because we're afraid. So it would just be like, stop justifying why you can't go or why you shouldn't go. And just do it. I think a lot of, especially like husbands and dads, we sort of let guilt drive that. We think, well, I can't, you know, I only get so much vacation time and to spend a chunk of it away from my wife and kids. Seriously, I think I've said it before, but you will be a better man coming back out of the woods, and you'll be better man for them if you get that time. So I would say don't use that as an excuse. You know, have some honest conversations with your wife or whoever, and that this is important to you and you really want to give this a shot, and hopefully she supports you in that. And don't let money stand in the way either. Hunting's a business and an industry like anything else, and there is a lot of stuff that can be crazy expensive. But you can also go out there in Walmart camo with a used cheap bow, and you know, like, you can have second and third rate everything and still get out of there. I packed the two quarters and the rack of that elk out on the worst torture device of a pack frame I have ever encountered. And I'm still alive. Like, it was, right. It was stupid how bad that was. And it still worked out.
I think I saw some photos of that. Did you say you ratchet strapped quarters onto that thing?
Yeah. Yeah. So this was, other thing I've been learning a lot lately is to test your gear. So, I have, or had a pack. I don't know if I'm allowed to badmouth other pack companies on your podcast, but it wasn't one of yours. And I never tested the meat compartment. So I had an elk quartered and on the ground, and finally, for the first time, unzipped that thing, and it opened up maybe 2 inches. Like, you couldn't fit a guinea pig quarter in that thing. And so I'm like, holy crap, what am I going to do now? And my father-in-law had come out to meet us. And he was walking around with this, I don't know where he found this thing, but it was this like plastic frame that he had bought really just to haul his tree stand into the woods. And he had also bought these, like, they were like army surplus straps and belt. And when we were taking his tree stand out there, I was helping him like find lash points to like rig this thing up. And the belt was, man, it had all the padding of like a Civil War bandage. And it was just, it was the most uncomfortable thing. And yeah, so I was like, well, shoot, I can't fit any quarters in my pack. So I decided to take his pack frame, which is just this like plastic skeleton. So he had ratchet straps with him, and we ratchet strapped the front and the rear quarter on there and just kind of lashed the horns and a couple other things. And we shoved like the back straps and the ground meat and stuff in my little tiny meat compartment. And my father-in-law put on that pack, and oh my God, the pain level of it would have been a heavy pack with a good pack, but just the way that thing was torquing and like cracking and twisting, I was like almost hunched over 90 degrees by the time I got out of the woods. It hurt so bad.
Oh man.
I think I'm going to be laughing for the next year. I couldn't fit a guinea pig quarter.
It was so small. Who designs a pack like that?
Yeah. Oh man, well, I saw that picture because I was kind of scanning through one of your blog articles, and I'm like, it literally looks like quarters are just hanging off of your back, like not like secured to the pack, but literally just kind of like hanging and strapped. And then I kind of read something about those ratchet straps. That's hilarious. How long was that pack out?
It was only 3 miles. But
that's 3 miles of hell, though.
It was so miserable. Yeah. Like, it probably would have been more comfortable to just like throw them on my shoulders like a lumberjack and walk out of there. It was so bad.
Oh man, that's so funny. So where can guys go if they want to check out the videos? Like, you have your hunting videos, you also have put out some cool stuff with like tips and things like that, as well as articles. What's the best place to make sure that listeners can go see your stuff?
Everything's kind of on the website, latetothegameoutdoors.com. And then that's the same name as the YouTube channel, so you could always search up there. I'm most active from a social media perspective, probably on Instagram. And I just kind of push a lot of that content through to Facebook and Twitter. But I'm pretty sure on all platforms, I've managed to keep the name like Late to the Game Outdoors. So the website can direct you to everything, or if you search on your particular platform, that name should get you there.
Awesome. Well, Eric, man, thanks for joining us. Thanks for sharing the stories. It's been helpful to some listeners. I'm sure it's been entertaining. It's been fun. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you guys for having me on. It's been awesome.
Well, that's a wrap. Thank you guys, as always, for tuning in. Again, we would love to have your feedback, so share that with us. Either leave us a review or email us to podcast@exomongear.com. Thank you for tuning in.